I'm having battery problems here. Both the batteries are dead. So we might have to keep juggling these things. So if you can't hear me, tell me, I will juggle batteries. Somebody forgot to charge batteries here. So to reminder, what we've been talking about is concurrency. This is a topic that's going to be around for a while. We talked about semaphores. And we talked about how to use semaphores for critical sections, which is pretty simple, and how to use semaphores for synchronization, which still looks pretty simple, but it won't be. There's a lot of stuff you can do with it. Today I'm going to be a little jumpy. I've got several not very well connected topics to talk about, so it's like not very highly structured. I know that's complaint, but I will once in a while have to do that. So let me first start with a very simple thing. Let's say I have two threads and I have increment of x in a loop, let's say four times. So I'm just going to write it out four times instead of putting it in a loop. And I have and I initialize x to 0, and when they both come here, they finish, what's the value of x? We've done things like that before. This is basics. If you understand this, we'll go to semaphores next. We've already gone to semaphores, but by now maybe you should understand this. I've done 8 increments, so I want the value of x to be 8. But there's race conditions, so it may or may not be 8. What can I expect it to be? Yeah.
You can expect at the very least it would be 4.
At least 4, at most 8. How do you get 4?
Because there's a rule of 4 lines that contain the x-axis on both.
Yeah, but how does it, when executing, end up with 4?
Because, well, let's say worst case scenario, the entirety of one column overlap the other.
Okay. And each two increments incremented by 1. Right? There could be many other ways of doing this. One would be both of them load, increment by 1, store 1. That's the first. Next, pull it out, increment by another 1. So it can be 4. And it can be 5, it can be 6, it can be 7. Here's the problem. It can be 2. I want somebody to show me how it can be 2. These are the horrible subtleties of concurrency. Yes.
So there's read, write, read, increment, and write.
Read, increment, and write.
So if the first two ones start off like right next to each other, so read, and then the next one, and while it's incrementing, the next one reads, and it's still 0.
Yeah, that's the two.
No, even in thread 1.
No.
Okay.
This is sequential. So it'll read, increment, write, one after the other. So I have a friend called Rida Bazi. I think many of you may have run into him. He told me to give out a much harder version of this problem on the exam, because he keeps telling me my stuff is too easy. So I watered it down, and I thought I'll cover it in class, because nobody will figure this out on an exam.
So say it starts on T1 at read, X, and then all of T2 goes through the last one.
Yeah.
And then just before it starts the last one there, it writes the one increment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it stalls there after it reads the one, and the last two goes through all of T1, and then it finishes the last T2.
That won't be two. You're almost there, but it reads the zero, and this completes and has not written four yet. And then.
Oh no, it completes to three.
Oh, it completes to three.
Right, and then the other one writes down as one. And then it reads
one, and then the other one completes. Yes, that's the correct answer. Okay, here's how it works. First, we run all these three. Okay? And we finish the write of three. No, we haven't written three yet. We have written two. No, that doesn't work.
Are you going to start?
I'm going to start here. This loads zero.
Right.
This one completes all the way through.
No, so now, to the third one.
To the third one, that's right.
And it writes three.
And it writes three. Then it goes. It goes here. Then it goes back here, this right one. Then it comes back here,
read
one. And then it goes back here, right whatever, four. And then this will write two. It's that nasty. Is that obvious? No. It's terribly subtle. The moral of the story is that you should never use anything that goes concurrently updating. There must be critical sections. Now, if I put two critical sections, one over here, one over here, what would be the final value? Put both in critical sections. What will be the final value?
Eight.
Nothing other than eight. If we broke it down and put a critical section here, critical section here, critical section here, critical section here, and similarly, what will be the final value? Eight. So any time you make sure there's no conflict, it'll give you the value eight, because there are eight increments. That's the way to do it. Because trying to figure out how a concurrent program steps on each other is beyond us mortals' comprehension. This is too simple. I can just make it more and more complex, throw in some subtractions and some multiplications, and you're dead. Okay. Now, does that mean by critical sections we can now completely simplify stuff and have easy to understand programs? Sadly, the answer is no. Because that brings up another level of complexity that we have to deal with. So why are we going through with all this? Because it started in the 50s, if not 1960s, with dealing with operating systems kernels. Putting it out at a user programming tool came much later. Operating systems folks knew about this stuff way back in the dark ages, but didn't let out the secrets, saying programmers are not very smart people. But now, this is out there. Every language, package, operating system has the threading abilities. So yes, things are bad out there if you use threads. You'd better know what concurrency is all about. So my second topic okay, now, before even I do that, does anybody have questions on this? That, yes, critical sections will give me 8. This looks like it'll be 4 to 8, but it's not really true. The lowest number you can get here is 2. And so you can get 2, you can get 3, you can get 4, you can get all the values between 2 and 8. In fact, maybe you should work out how do you get 3. Yeah.
Could you get 1?
No, you cannot get 1. Because at least 2 increments will happen. You cannot get 0, you cannot get 1. You can get 2. But do take another look at this. So how to implement threads? Because I haven't posted the assignment yet, the next assignment is implement threads. So I'm going to go over quite a bit of the coding of how to do it, and whatever I do here is also will be part, there'll be some code given to you already to make it simpler, and it'll be part of the assignment, we'll provide the code. Easiest way of building threads is to use the pthreads library. There is a library in Linux, also exists in other places, which has threads already implemented. Okay, so it provides abilities to create threads, delete threads, pause them, schedule them, do semaphores, do monitors, everything possible you want to do with threads, critical sections, locking, everything's provided. But, as I was saying at some point, that we are trying to see how operating systems do things. So yes, the whole operating system is implemented. Do we have to even know about operating systems? We want an operating system, we just get it off of the shelf. There are several around. No, there's an operating systems class, how do they work? So operating systems, people who build operating systems cannot assume the existence of anything. You've got to build every feature from scratch. So how can you build threads from scratch? Not by using the pthreads library. At a minimum, you need to create process control blocks so that you can do context switching. And queues, the assignment's already there. You probably have done your queues or will be doing it pretty soon. Okay? So, we need queues. We need a scheduler. This is what today's class will be about. And we need PCBs. Now, what do PCBs contain? Stack pointers. It contains registers. It contains some other stuff. It contains limits of memory for the stack and things like that. And then you've got to write the context switching routines. Both of these need, at a minimum, a few lines or tens of lines of assembly code. So I wanted to avoid telling you you've got to use assembly code to do this. Not only it's you have to use assembly code, you've got to very keenly understand the architecture of the machine, which is Intel, not MIPS. MIPS is much easier. And you've got to get everything correct. Every bit and byte has to be in the correct place, otherwise it won't work. So it's going to take you a long time to debug where is this extended flags register and how am I putting it and where in the stack must it be so that the interrupt handler picks it up properly and all that. So I'm going to make it easier for you in that respect, that we will go ahead and use a few library routines which encapsulates just the assembly code needed to do this. Okay? So, before I get there, what we're so we're going to do user-level threads because it's very similar to how an operating system builds threads. We're not going to assume the operating system has any support for threads. So you don't have system calls. You have only the process that you get for free when you run a C program. The main routine starts up as a process due to the fact the operating system gives you a process. That process is your CPU. Now that you have a CPU, can we build a rudimentary operating system and make it run multiple processes or threads? That's the challenge. So, again, to make it simpler, I'm going to use non-preemptive scheduling. That is, I'm not going to hook up the timer interrupt, which is a privileged operation anyway, to schedule these threads. I will use another form of scheduling within the threads, which I'll call non-preemptive scheduling, which you'll see how it works. Okay? Fine. So to do this, I need to set up my ready queue, which is a bunch of PCBs of things that I want to run as threads. So the magic should start at, in main, somewhere, I should be able to use a routine called start thread and give it a function. And run those. Now, I demoed how to do this in the sense that I showed that I can write the stuff, which I didn't show you the code, but the high-level code of start thread, and run it. So I want to be able to write the code for start thread. What will be the code for start thread? So high-level pseudocode here. I will have to define something which is a type, which is PCB. So it has a bunch of fields. I have to allocate a stack. Actually, I'm going to change this a little. I have to initialize the PCB to have the stack pointer in it and the starting address somehow to the function that was passed to start thread. Then I have to insert this PCB into my run queue. Okay? And then I return, which means this thread that I've created does not run. It is just a PCB in a queue. What will happen to the thread that comes in, the process that comes in, does all this and goes out? So the main process will do this and continue so that we can do as many start threads as we want. The little change I want to make here that I allocate a PCB, I allocate a queue item. The queue item is a little bit more than a PCB. The PCB is inside the queue item, that's the payload. In your project, I said the payload is an integer. Now the payload will be a PCB and a thread ID. So there'll be two things in the PCB, in the queue item. So I allocate a queue item, I allocate a stack, I take the PCB from the queue item somehow to initialize what I'm doing, and then I put the queue item into the ready queue. Make sense? What does it do? Very little. It's just manipulating data structures. It's not doing anything with control flow. But if I do this multiple times, there'll be multiple things in the ready queue. So what is this PCB? The PCB there is a type called ucontext.t in the ucontext library, I'll give you the template, which contains all the fields needed to store a PCB. You don't need to know. You can go to the library, look at the source code, but even if you don't, it'll work. It contains the correct set of fields. And the queue item that you will be building will consist of the next and previous pointers, just like you've done. They're pointers to queues. And it'll contain one of these elements, ucontext, we'll call it PCB, and throw in an integer also, just to maintain thread IDs. Okay? And we go back here and initialize thread ID. We can have a global counter, which we increment every time we do start thread, and we get a new serial number for that thread. That's a thread ID. And once we put it into the ready queue, it has the context and the thread ID. This initializing PCB to point to F is a little tricky. Anyway, I'm trying to copy this code. TCB T is TCB, TCB context. No, this is good. That's fine. I'm getting a little confused because I was using different terminologies in my notes. So init TCB is a function that I fumbled to write out. Init TCB, you will have to write this function. In fact, a template is provided. It uses names that are quite different from what I just wrote down, but you'll figure all that out. I call it TCB or something like that. Init TCB is, you give it a queue item. You give it the function that process thread should run. You give it a stack pointer. How do you give it a stack pointer? stack pointer is a stack pointer for the thread you're going to create now. To give it a stack pointer, you need to give it an address of a piece of memory where it can put its stack. How would you do that? To call this routine, I need to provide an address to free memory, or just fresh memory, where these routines will put a stack for the thread. It's not a trick question. Yeah. Malloc. Just malloc, give it a size, and it'll return you a pointer. Use that as your stack pointer. So malloc, so let's say I pick a stack size. Stack size is around 8K, let's say. 8K is good enough. 8K is what? 4096.8192. So stack pointer will be malloc 8192. Got it? I believe so. 8K? How much is 8K? That's right. If it's not, fix it. Then I'll give you a funny little code to put zeros in into the queue item. Just zero it out. We'll fix it later. Then that PCB part of the queue item needs some very strange initialization. There's a routine provided in the uContext library that will initialize it, use it. And then you have to set two variables in the PCB field. One has this strange name called uc_stack.ss_sp. Okay? If you get it wrong, you'll get a compilation error. So you just copy-paste some code and put in that right string, and you'll get it right, and you give it the stack pointer. So in that PCB, you are actually putting in the stack pointer and putting in the stack size, and then you're calling a routine which will cook the PCB properly, called makeContext. And makeContext wants the address of the PCB and wants the function that you want to put. And the next argument has some meaning. We're just putting a zero which says, don't bother, just do this. It can do more. And that's how you make a PCB. We haven't started running any yet, but we kind of, the most tricky part is to build the PCB that when executed will run. And that's not so tricky. Right? Anybody has questions? Okay. Should I do yield or run? So there is a library routine called swap context. This is the context switcher. It will properly use the stacks and the PCB fields to move the thread from one context to the other. And what it will do is the calling thread, when you come to swap context, it will do something like save the current instruction pointer, program counter, and the current state of the stack into a PCB pointed to by the first argument, which we'll call from. From is the first argument. You can call it anything you want. But into the PCB in the first argument, it'll save its local context. And it'll pull out a context from the to field, which is another PCB. And the execution will immediately jump to wherever this one was saved. It may not return here, or it'll go away somewhere. Okay? So this is the powerful one. It is a context switcher. So how do we use it? So in the main routine, we are doing start thread, and then we'll do run. And the run routine is the one that starts running all the threads. And the run routine will do... Where is the run routine? Context Okay, this depends on how you build your queues. So the run routine is a routine which we'll look at the exact details of the code in a minute. But the first two lines of this is kind of sloppy code, I agree. I'm allocating another TCB to store the context of the parent, which I'm not going to be using ever again. I could use it, I could go back to the parent, I can set up the system that way. In my design, I'll never go back to the parent, which is sloppiness number one. So I make it a local variable. I initialize the context here, not really initialize, this is some magic sauce that you've got to do so that some of the fields are initialized properly. And then I'm going to do a swap context, which will put the context of this point of execution into the parent context, which will get lost, and I jump to the first PCB. Where is the first PCB? That depends upon how you set up the queue. So I will cross this out and say, the first PCB on the ready queue. Now, the ready queue can be structured in many different ways. So I'll show you one way, and if you structure it that way, you can do this. Many different ways is These are the things that are waiting. This is the one that will run. This gets a little tricky. So what I suggest that you do is you, in my notes I call it the run queue, and the run queue contains all these things that are waiting, and there is the run queue pointer. The name of the queue is the pointer to the first element. This is the first element. And here is the PCB. So, run queue PCB is the first PCB to run. Okay? You have created threads and put it in the run queue. I'm calling it run queue. You can call it ready queue. And the first one that was created is here. It is pointed to by your queue header pointer. The queue header pointer is pointing to that element. So this is technically not part of the ready queue. It is the current process. And you pull out the PCB from there, give it to swap context, and that thread will start executing it from the beginning. It actually works. Okay? But now what's going to happen? You will have this thread running forever now, if it's got an infinite loop. I suggest all of your threads have infinite loops, because we're not going to design how to stop threads. That's another long story. So if you're not going to stop threads, just keep them running forever. It'll be easier. So the moment you start this guy, it will go from here. The control flow will come to run queue, will go here, will go there, will immediately go to F, which runs forever. And here, this routine will never come back. Any questions? That this swap context will go away forever. Your parent context will be lost, but we are not using it. It goes and runs the first thread forever. But that's not exactly what we want, but that's what's going to happen. Okay, so what are we going to do from now? We want all the threads to run. We don't have preemption. The first thread I am running will not get preempted. It'll run forever. So I want to build my own non-preemptive scheduler. So I want the thread to say, can you move on? I've done enough. Go to the next thread. And that is a call that is very commonly used in operating systems called yield. Yield to the next guy. So the function f, there's many such functions f. F will be an infinite loop, print something.
Did you say finite or infinite?
Infinite. Sleep for maybe one, and then do a yield. And that way, what will happen is this yield should go to the next thread, which will have a yield, which will go to the next thread. Eventually, it will come back to this yield, and it will execute the next loop. And here, things get a little tricky. Let's implement yield. No arguments. Yield means I am a thread that is at the beginning of the run queue. Please do something so that you're running the thread which is next to me. So, what I will do when I come here is And that's pretty much all the code you need to write for the next project. It'll be too easy, but you should be a little amazed when it works, because it'll do things that you haven't seen programs do, which is jumping around between functions which contain infinite loops, because you will put in the yields in your appropriate places. So what does this yield do? It grabs a pointer to the PCB at the top of the ready queue, rotates the ready queue. Now the top of the ready queue is the next guy. It grabs a pointer to that. So we've got from and to. And then call swap context, save the context in from, which has gone to the end, but you've got a pointer there, pulls out the context from to and doesn't come back. It goes away to to. And then to will go to the next one in the queue. That will go to the next one in the queue. That will go to, let's say we've got three, that should come back here. When it does a swap context, it's going to resume where the first thread let off. The first thread was doing a swap context when it ran away. So it's going to just return from the swap context as if nothing has happened. Let me diagrammatically try to show you this. So we have three processes. Thread one came, did a yield, did a swap. Okay? This guy, the thread of control, comes here, comes to this, goes to wherever thread 2 starts executing. Thread 2 will do a yield, which is the same yield, but it will do a swap from 2, which will cause it to run to thread 3. Thread 3 will do the same thing. This swap, where will it go? We have only three threads. If it was four, then it would have gone to the fourth thread. This will go, so the queue comes around. The TCB that is at the front of the queue is T1's. When we load the context of T1, we come here. And then we return from the swap. So that means this guy goes here and starts executing. So that means the yield finishes and it starts executing whatever is after the yield. Until it hits a yield again, when it does a swap, and that will go to this location. So these are strange go-tos. And that's a real context switch. And we've just got a FIFO round robin scheduler whose timeouts, instead of being the clock, is the yields in the code itself. So that it's not preemptive, but the yields are the preemption programmed into the code in the thread process. And so at the end of this, you'll have threads running. Any questions? And that is a scheduler. We just wrote a scheduler.
So swap provides the context switch.
Swap just provides the context switch. I could have said don't use swap, then you'll have to really spend a lot of time figuring out how to get the context switching right. But how does the context switcher work? I kind of gave you the pseudocode for the context switcher. It's just that assembly and getting each slot correctly positioned is just too much busy work. I'll take questions. So I'll provide some of the code. You'll have to write the main drivers, that is the functions, the test routines, the start thread routine, pseudocode. So you'll have to make the thing really work, hook it up back into your queue routines, and it works. And if it doesn't work, you have pointer problems or queue problems. A lot of people find pointers very confusing, but that's how things work in real life, pointers. Yeah?
So we're putting our yields pretty much in the code itself, so how does like a real scheduler like on a real operator operate?
On a real scheduler, instead of a yield, there's a timer. And the timer is an interrupt handler which contains the yield, just the yield, that's all. So we're not that far away. If we had an interrupt handler, we could put our yield in it and it will start switching automatically. So if you're fine with this, then we will go in back to playing with our semaphores. Now, people over the years have had a lot of fun with semaphores. And semaphore programs is a general programming tool. You can do synchronization. You can do critical sections. Can we build certain classical, these are called classical So this synchronization mutual exclusion thing, you know, with any programming language, you can write anything. But often you get certain sample situations like, okay, build a queue, build a tree, build a balanced tree. These are things that are very well-known structures, if you're doing data structures, that you learn from by doing it. In the whole process coordination arena, some folks have abstracted various types of process coordination that happen in real systems and put it into a theoretical framework and said, can you write programs to solve at least these three problems? There's about six or seven problems that are called classical process coordination problems. And one of them is the bounded buffer problem, also known as producer-consumer. It is an abstraction of hundreds of things that happen in a computer operating system. And I'll give you examples. When you're typing on the keyboard, keystrokes are going into a buffer from which an application program reads. The application program can only read the thingies that are in the buffer. And if it's too fast, it shouldn't read keystrokes that you haven't typed in yet. It has to stop and wait for you to type. Similar things happen with networking. You are sending out network packets. As you dump them on the networking interface, that has a certain speed, and generally the computer is faster. So if you cannot keep on generating packets and put it there. You've got to stop somewhere because the buffer has a certain size. And the incoming packets are also coming in, and you cannot pick them up too fast. You have to coordinate the speed of your data generation or data consumption based on external entities that's controlling. Same thing happens with buffering, as in file systems and disks and all that, where you have some memory buffers where you put stuff in which are going out to disk, or you're doing pre-reading into an input buffer and you have programs reading from there. So there's a lot of speed mismatches between different things in a computer, particularly at the operating system level, that needs to be coordinated with synchronization. And that's the starting point of bounded buffer or producer-consumer problems. In applications programming, multi-threaded applications programming, it's very common to write a program that starts generating data, like image processing will generate a first round of the enhanced image, which will go to the next phase of the processor, which will do, and these things can run in parallel on multiple cores and move data across threads so that you get some speed up, and different things do different types of processing on that. But all of these, the speeds of these things have to be coordinated. They're not running at the same speed. Some are computing more than the others, but their speeds have to match up in the end. And the controller is the bounded buffer system. So what is a bounded buffer problem in its abstraction? The bounded buffer problem says there's a buffer into which we can put items. So let's say this is a part of a supermarket shelf. And there are producers, these are people who stock the shelf, and there are lots of them, for some reason, who will put items on the shelf. And this is organized as somewhat of a queue that you go and stock it. But you cannot put more than the number of items, amount of space. Let's say we have space for 10 soup cans. So you can have at most 10 soup cans there. And each producer, there are many producers, they come in and they're not very smart. They just put one soup can in there. If they can find space, go away, go find another soup can, bring it back and put it there. But if it's full, they just stand there and wait to put the soup can in. Whereas we have consumers, who take, and they will take one soup can at a time. However, you cannot overflow or underflow, or you cannot duplicate. When a consumer takes a soup can, it shouldn't be that the soup can has been taken and as well as it's there, which can happen because of race conditions. A producer should not put two soup cans into the same slot because they will overwrite each other. Unlike soup cans which have a volume, data does not. We can put 10 pieces of data into the same piece of memory, the first 9 disappears, right? So the analogy is there, but not quite with data, but we have to make data slots behave like a shelf of soup cans. So the producer code should look like an infinite loop which so you manufacture the soup, or you just go find it somewhere in the back and you get a brand new soup and you come and put it on the shelf. Now, if the put on the shelf, I have to put in all kinds of code to guarantee that I only can put if there's space, and I don't overwrite anything. So it's the put routine that I want to write. Similarly, the consumer will be an infinite loop take from shelf and eat. So I'm not interested in how they eat soup, but how do they take it? The take routine I've got to write. And the puts and the takes, there are multiple producers, multiple consumers. The puts and the takes should not trample on each other. And take should not, so if this is arranged as a circular list, I take. I can't do that. I have to make sure that it's there. Otherwise, since the slots are there, we can keep taking data out of there. And it'll be wrong. So number in should equal number out, and the amount that is produced but not consumed can be between zero and a bounded number, n. That's why it's called a bounded buffer. So there are n slots here. Fine? So to do this, I'm going to first simplify the problem a little bit, and I'll say there's one producer and one consumer. That helps with my trampling problem. And then I'll go to multiple producer, multiple consumer. One producer, one consumer. So I'm going to set up my data structure first. I have an n-item buffer. I wrote int over there, but it probably should be a struct, with multiple things in each slot. But I'm assuming each soup can is an integer. Again, oversimplifying, but I can make it an array, I can make it a struct, I can make it whatever. So I've got an array of these things. I have two pointers. And these are not real pointers, these are just indices into the array, and I set them both to zero. And I'm assuming the array is empty. I don't even have to initialize it because I will not look at any uninitialized item in the buffer array. Okay? So my put routine Okay, this is not quite right, but it's got the general structure here. I'm putting stuff, anytime I call something, I put it in the buffer at the position in, and I increment the in. I cannot increment it beyond the end of the buffer. This is the modulus operator. So it'll go from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's say the buffer is 5. It'll go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. So now you see an overflow situation. If I run put 6 times, it'll override the first item. Right? I'd better stop that. And if I... The two independent threads, one calling get at any speed, one calling put at any speed. And if I don't control their behaviors, there'll be either overflow, where things will start disappearing, or underflow. What is underflow? Where things that don't exist keeps going out the door. How do you stop that? So you use two semaphores, and I'll call them P and M, full and empty. This is the simplest piece of semaphore code that you should memorize for life. That's how I can write it anytime, because this is from memory. It comes up so often when you write thread programs because you move data around through a buffer. So if you have a buffer, you should have two semaphores. One, give it any name, S1, S2, doesn't matter. I'm calling it full and empty. Full is a semaphore initialized to n. Empty is a semaphore initialized to 0. You do P full, V empty, P empty, V full. And now you've got to figure out why does it work? Because it works very nicely. It works, I'll give you the first basic step. If I do too many puts and there's no gets, I'm going to do 8. This is 5, so it'll go to 4. Empty will go to 1, go to 3, this will go to 2, and this will keep happening until the 5th time things will be fine, the 6th time full is 0. So it will get blocked right here. It will not try to produce anything. Okay? Same thing reversed. It starts with 0, so I cannot get anything out of the shelf if nothing has been put in there. So it's 0, I'm stuck. If somebody puts something, VMT will make it 1, I can grab. So producers can be faster, in which case the shelf will always be full, or consumers can be faster, in which case the shelf will always be empty. They can be approximately of the same speed, where the shelf kind of grows and shrinks in the number of quantity, and it just takes care of itself. There are these pointers in and out. Can we have race conditions on those pointers?
I don't think so.
Don't think so? Why not? In and out are two separate variables. Are there two threads using in and out at the same time? Is that possible? Or using in at the same time or using out at the same time? No, because I said one producer, one consumer. If I said two producers and two consumers, then this program is not correct. Okay. Second thing is, I am not counting how many things are in the buffer. Is the buffer full or is the buffer empty? Is there any way of knowing? Is there any way of checking if I wanted to check? Does in equal out signify buffer is empty or buffer is full? Will in will ever become equal to out? So in moves this way, out moves this way. So I'm, what is this space empty or full? Empty? Yeah. Somewhere here to here. So if I go take out, it'll go all the way around and will in will become equal to out. That means the whole buffer is empty. But if I start filling things and out is not moving, then in will become equal to out, which means the buffer is full. So in equal to out can mean empty or full. We don't know, we don't care. The counting is done by a semaphore. Can I throw in some counters? Yes, you can. But then the counters will have race conditions, so you need to fix the code. Can I look at the value of the semaphore? The semaphore tells me how many full slots are there and how many empty slots are there. No, you're not allowed to look at a value of a semaphore. Semaphores are not integers, although it is integers, but no. You can only use initialize P and V. No peaking. And I can show you that you never need to peak, and if you do peak, you'll probably write buggy code. You'll get it wrong if you look at the value of a semaphore, because if you look, you're going to make decisions based on what you saw, which could have changed by now. So don't look at a value of a semaphore. It is automatically, atomically updated and functions with P's and V's. So think about how you would make it multiple producer, multiple consumer. I'll show you the code next time, but that's what we want to do. Thank you.